This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your No Man is an Archive, although some certainly try, of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Well, I'm gonna write a little letter, I'm gonna mail it to my local DJ. Yeah, this is a jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today. You know my temperature rising, the jukebox blowing a fuse. My heart beating rhythm and my soul keep a singing the blues. I roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news. I got the rockin' pneumonia, I need a shot of rhythm and blues. I caught the rolling off the writer sitting down at a rhythm review. I roll over Beethoven, they rockin' in two by two.
I am enraged and infuriated. If you are a podcast listener, I would say there is a strong likelihood that yesterday you read the New York Times Magazine story by Jody Rosen about the Universal Music Group warehouse fire of 2008. Jody's here, and we're going to have a big talk about all the behind the scenes of the reporting and the implications for what he discovered. But before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about my collection. There are a lot of things happening in the world that caused me no end of existential angst. There was something very specific about what was on display in this story. There was a big warehouse fire. A bunch of master recordings owned by Universal were apparently lost. And we're talking potentially about 500,000 songs. Incredibly well-known stuff. Everybody from Patsy Cline to 50 Cent. But also obscurities and things that we will never know. Songs that maybe only existed on a reel that was sitting in that warehouse and now is gone forever. It's very upsetting to me for a number of personal reasons. Obviously, the preservation of music, music history, these are things that are very near and dear to my heart. I think a lot about my moral relationship with music history. And I know that's maybe an abstract concept, but let me physicalize it for a second. Those who know me well know that I have a storage unit, and I've had it for a bunch of years, and those who know me for a long time know that for many years prior to that, I lived effectively in my storage unit. I lived with thousands of CDs, thousands of records. They were important to me. I had them alphabetized. They filled up a lot of space, and this is about acquisition. It's about passion. Really, before the digital era, the way that you could demonstrate how enthusiastic you were about music, that was reflected in what you owned and what you sought out. These are things that are rare and things that were hard to find, and maybe I have one of only a handful of copies of. That was all incredibly important to me. Now, obviously, in the streaming era, a lot of that stuff's available on the internet, you know, whether formally through a streaming service or via bootlegs. That's all well and good. I don't live with those things anymore. I have them in storage. A lot of people who I know and who I have loved and who have loved me over the years are sort of like, do you really need all this? Is this stuff important? And it's hard for people who I think don't think about music the way that I think about music. It's hard to really make that case. I'm not naive enough to think that my collection is somehow the best collection or the most rare collection, but I do know that increasingly, as record labels have weaned consumers off of ownership in favor of a streaming model, basically a renting access model, it's going to become easier and easier and easier for things to disappear. And I reject that. I don't accept it, man. I just simply don't. And if my storage unit and my collection is some small bulwark against the kind of increasing dematerialization of music, that's cool. I'm willing to pay whatever it takes a month to hold on to that stuff. It's meaningful to me. There are things in there that I know are hard to find and hard to come by, and that maybe someday people will want to hear. I feel like the rub of the contemporary music business is that music isn't actually yours. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the labels. It belongs to the streaming services. That is not the generation I come from. The music that I bought is mine. It's meaningful to me. And maybe this makes me old-fashioned, but I am reluctant to let that go. And I have no intention of, really, for many years, up until probably pretty recently, I would rip copies of digital things that I was worried were disappearing or might disappear, and frankly, still might disappear. But I felt like as long as I held on to one copy, it wouldn't be gone forever. We've become accustomed in the internet age to impermanence, and we've accepted that things that are there this week may not be there next week or may not be there a year from now. And we've accepted that the caprices of streaming services or record labels or conglomerates of various kinds are in control of that. And we just have to shrug it off. But I want to fight back a little bit against that. And I know Jody is here today, and I know he's mad too. So before we begin the conversation, though, I do want to say one thing, which is if you are listening to Popcast, to this episode, or if you listen to Popcast in general, and you work at a major record label in some kind of executive capacity, I want to ask you, what are you doing to preserve the history of the music that your label owns? To say nothing of the music that your label is making right now, because there may be a circumstance 10, 20, 30 years from now, where something that gets put out today is somehow lost to time. So if you're of the mindset that that would be an unfortunate circumstance to befall the work that you are doing, imagine the moral imperative of helping to make sure that doesn't happen to the music of generations ago. So if you work at a label and you're listening to this, I hope it's encouraging you to think hard about what you can do to make sure that history is preserved. Just to give you a sense of the scale of what has been lost, this is Etta James' At Last. And this song, obviously, as you know, is one of the crucial documents of American culture. Forget music, American culture. And I'm not saying you can't go hear At Last in 100 different places, but without the master recording, without that original session file, you're never going to hear it as it originally was recorded. So before we start talking, let's hear the best version that we can find of At Last.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over. Wrapped up in clover. The night I looked at you.
Jody Rosen's in the studio. Jody, I'm mad.
I'm
upset.
Yeah.
Maybe my bar for infuriation has been raised so high because of the state of America recently.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something very particular about the nature of venality that is on display in your story,
mm-hmm,
that hit me in a very personal place as someone who cares deeply about this subject matter and archiving and historical memory. So Jody, for those who don't know, Jody has written about pop music for many years. He's working on a book right now.
Like literally. I'm multitasking right here in the studio.
About the history of the bicycle that's coming out next year, I believe.
2020, baby.
That's right. Tell a friend. Get your two wheelies up. So, and Jody, I feel like once every few years you come around with a story that is a history of history. In a way, I'm thinking of the earliest recording thing from a few years back.
Right.
I know that your interests are myriad, but also in the history and the music of yesteryear and extreme yesteryear.
Yeah.
And so how that music is preserved and archived and collected, I know is of paramount importance to you. This story, explain to me how it first came on your radar. Not only was I offended about the subject of your story, I was mad at myself for not knowing more about this.
Right.
So how did it get put onto your radar?
So I didn't know anything about this either.
Yeah.
Which sort of offends me too now, thinking about it.
Right. I mean, this should be like, is it weirdly like pre-Twitter sort of?
I think it may, in fact, technically be exactly at the birth of Twitter.
Okay. But pre-hyperactive Twitter. Yeah.
Right. No, what happened was I got hold of some documents. So this story, a curious thing about this story is that it was out there, like low level.
Right.
It was sort of hidden in plain sight the whole time. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I said this in the piece, but like up until very recently, probably up until the other day, it had lived on the Wikipedia page, this news for like the past 3.5 years, just like a lot of Decca and chess masters burn up in the vault. And
shrug.
Yep.
Yeah.
For various legal reasons, I couldn't, which was odd, but I couldn't say this in the story, but there was a joke about the backlot vault fire on an episode of 30 Rock in October 2008.
What?
For real. Anyway, so the news has kind of been out there in and it's very much been a topic of discussion among engineers, the kinds of people who work on reissues. For some time, it's been a source of great consternation in those circles, and it's been out there on like audiophile and record collector message boards.
Right.
So once I found this out, I kind of went back and started looking around, and I was like, "Can I say that on this show?"
Yes.
Okay. Sorry.
Well, we might bleep you, but it's fine.
Okay. Fine. Okay.
Just be in your feelings.
Okay. I was like, "Wow, this news has been out there, but it's never been kind of reported out."
Yeah.
And what happened was I got a hold of a kind of raft of documents, a lot of paperwork, both legal papers, documents related to litigation.
Internal UMG
resulted
stuff as well.
From the fire. Yeah. And part of those legal documents were a lot of internal UMG documents and correspondence, emails, that sort of stuff. So at first, when I got all that stuff, I was like, wow, what is this? I kind of had to,
hack through the
brambles to even to reconstruct a narrative of events.
That's right, kids, hack through the brambles.
That's
rule number one.
Yeah. So I did that, and then, not to mix the metaphors more, but like the mist kind of parted at some point, and I was like, okay, I get this. And then I went trying to find people who really knew about this stuff, and I managed to get some people to speak to me on record, and some people maybe to speak to me off record about it, and was able to pull it all together. And
this has been for three or four years.
It's been percolating for on and off for that time. It was slow because a lot of people were reluctant to talk about
it. Of course.
And also I had to wrap my mind around it, and I wanted to be very precise in what I was saying. And the other thing I'll say is that a master tape is a weird, funky kind of artifact.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you said that, because I do think, I feel like the people who listen to this show are really passionate about music. They're passionate about consuming music, but may not be aware of all the kind of mechanisms that are happening 3-4 steps before it arrives on the Spotify Rap Caviar.
Right.
So can you explain what a master is, how a master has changed over the years, and what the hell these things were doing in a warehouse next to the King Kong ride?
Those are all good questions.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, so that could be its own episode, just that.
So let's try and deal with a master tape a little bit. And I will say, by way of a caveat, honestly, I'm not the foremost authority on this. I had to kind of, even as someone who's made a living at times writing exclusively about music, it was a bit mysterious to me. Mm-hmm. But like the simplest way to say it is like the master is the document, okay? Mm-hmm. It's the primary source artifact of a piece of recorded music. there are different types of masters. The very first masters, there were wax cylinder masters mm-hmm. from which others were kind of molded mm-hmm. way back in the day, you know, 1890-something. And over the years, there's been new technologies developed which gave us different types of masters. There were kind of metal parts masters that were stamped mm-hmm. out. This is before the advent of magnetic tape recording. Mm-hmm. And then when tapes came around, you had that was a big sea change because you got greater fidelity in the recording. Like the sound was a whole lot better. Mm-hmm. And soon thereafter, there was the possibility of multi-tracking, that is recording discrete parts of a guitar line here, mm-hmm. a vocal here, and then in kind of post-production,
slapping
them all together. And then what you would get from that mix down of those disparate parts was the master. That is the primary source, first recording from which all subsequent copies were derived.
And basically what you're describing is functionally mimicked in online recording software currently, where you have multiple tracks and like that's mimicking that kind of recording.
Exactly.
Right.
But the crucial thing here is that it is the original, and what the reason that matters, there's a bunch of reasons that matters, but first and foremost, it's like, it's where you get the best sound.
Yeah. So you mentioned this in your piece, and I almost thought you downplayed it, and I feel like I want to emphasize it.
I want to hear you emphasize it, John. Okay. Go for it.
Recording technology mm-hmm. is far more advanced than playback technology.
Right.
That is something that I think needs to be emphasized over and over again, because I think part of what your piece is trying to do is encourage people to leap the chasm between what they hear and these things that are lost. They may not understand how vast that chasm is. You have that lovely section about the Beatles, yeah. about kind of going back to Sgt. Pepper's and kind of like reimagining what it actually was intended to be right. or recorded as. But I think the technology being the limitation for all these years, that there was not playback technology sophisticated enough. It seems weird that like you would ravel something and then unravel it, but like somehow the unraveling would be less effective than the wrap.
Right.
The,
right.
Know. But that's really what you're saying.
That is really what we're saying. In fact, like not to get super old school on you again, but brought it up at the beginning of the podcast. Yeah. Like, so some years ago, I wrote a piece for the Times about this discovery of the very oldest extant recording.
Absolutely.
Which was, before the idea of audio playback even existed, this guy named Edouard Léon, something Léon de Martinville.
That's right.
Something like that.
What do you got, like high school French there? What do you got?
No. I speak some French. You want me to flow on a track?
Un petit peu.
On peut se parler en français.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, but in any case, this guy invented this thing called a phonautograph. Mm-hmm. Which was a machine which essentially did like what you see on a Pro Tools thing, which it was like it took sound waves off. So someone spoke or sang into a recording horn, and it etched sound waves onto a piece of paper mm-hmm. using smoke, like it was called lamp blacking.
Damn.
So this is a piece of paper which was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was the 1860s mm-hmm. or 1870s mm-hmm. this recording was made. Well, with the development of a so-called digital stylus about 10 years ago
sure.
in a laboratory in Berkeley, they were able to extract the sound from a piece of paper from the mid-19th century.
Right. Just for the record, that track was not a banger.
No. It was not. Okay. But kind of incredible. But there you go. There's the parable of the recording mm-hmm. technology being and the playback technology mm-hmm. not exactly lining up.
Absolutely.
Right.
And this is something that I think that, from a consumer-facing perspective, all we really know is playback technology. So we know, like, are my headphones trash? Are AirPods trash? Yes. That's all we really understand. And maybe if I buy a better JBL speaker for the crib, maybe I get a better da-da-da-da. But ultimately, that's the range we're thinking of. Not even conceptualizing, there's a whole range that we don't yet have the technology to access.
Exactly. And now we have so many more tools than we ever did before. So that's mm-hmm. why I brought up the Beatles example, because Giles Martin, that's Sir George Martin's son,
yep.
went back to the original mono masters, and he wanted to create like a new stereo mix so that you could really hear Sgt. Pepper's mm-hmm. as the Beatles heard it. So you were getting like the kind of the art that the Beatles wanted to put out in the world.
I'm hoping they'll do that for Cracked Rear View. What do you think? You think that's going to happen
yeah,
soon?
Yeah, I read your piece, man.
Yeah, I'm just saying. If anybody out there has got the Hootie Masters and they want
to
go
in. Did they
in.
Burn up in the fire? I'm trying to remember.
No, they're on Atlantic.
So okay, fine. Okay. All good. All good. No, right. So the beat. So now, like, we hear that Sgt. Pepper's in that new mix because so much better because we had recourse to the master. So, right. Like, that new collection that came out, it hit harder.
Yeah.
Like, you could mm-hmm. you could hear Ringo's drums. Mm-hmm. That was more of a rock record,
mm-hmm.
which, and that's kind of a revelation because people think you of Sgt. Pepper's as.
It's not what you think of it as.
Right. And also, you kind of hear the ideas in the music with greater clarity. It really, like, the record just hits you at an emotional level harder.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is super salient, like, those recordings also, those master recordings included a lot of additional information.
So
So there was documentation in and on the tape boxes mm-hmm. telling us things about the sessions and what the Beatles wanted. And there were a hell of a lot of extra tracks and music.
Anytime you see, like, images of someone unearthing old tapes, films, audio, whatever,
yeah.
what I'm always drawn to is the notations.
Right. Right, exactly.
And who knows what that could be? That could be anything from an engineer's notes. It could be a producer's notes. It could be some record label guy. Who knows?
Exactly.
But it's a physical notation on this audio product, and it'll tell you something. And now not only is the master recording gone with his warehouse buyer, but all this kind of meta information.
Yeah, the metadata is gone. And it's a crucial point to wrap your head around is the fact that, like, this stuff was not well inventoried at this warehouse or in any
Dog.
Warehouse. And
even my storage unit's alphabetized. Jesus.
Right. So, like, so people, Come we don't on. Really know what was lost. Actually, you know, it's funny. I should just throw this in, but
Go
like,
in.
You know, Tom Petty lost some masters in this fire. I was a little nervous about that at some point. Cause I kept seeing in the documents that he'd lost stuff. I spoke to sources. He said he had stuff in there. And I was like, Petty really lose stuff? How could that happen? But then I noticed that UMG has not put out a lot of reissues
from a particular time period.
Yeah. And in fact, like, the big collection that dropped right after he died
mm-hmm.
was strangely represented just a couple of recordings, and there were a whole lot of holes in there. So anyway, that's just anecdotal. That's not dispositive. But anyway, back to Petty. He was a guy who apparently made beautiful drawings all over all his tape boxes. That was like his thing. Okay, that's not maybe like the greatest loss to art, but
no,
whatever. It's a thing.
It's a thing.
It's a thing.
Wouldn't you want to see that at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Someone could have dropped a real good coffee table book off that.
Absolutely. Rizzoli. That's a $69.95 of Rizzoli for sure. All right, so Jody, throughout this conversation, I feel like we should listen to some of these songs, the master recordings of which apparently have vanished into smoke. So there's a lot of heavy hitters. We're talking Muddy Waters, John Coltrane, Billie Holiday, et cetera, et cetera. Patsy Cline. Let's play Can Anyone Explain? This is Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald.
Can anyone explain the thrill of a kiss? No, no, no. But when two eager lips are pressed against yours, you'll know, yes, you'll know. Can anyone explain the glow of romance? No, no, no. But when you hear the phrase, it's you I adore, you'll know. Find to give love a start. Don't think with your mind, just feel with your heart.
Okay, so when we were texting about this yesterday, one of the things that we were talking about was ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking a lot about, you know, you're a young artist, you sign a deal with a subsidiary of a Universal Music Group or some other label, if it was 50 years ago, some small label, and you sign over your masters. And you don't really understand, you know, you're not aware of Prince and what Prince was saying about owning your masters or the masters own you. You don't know about Jay-Z buying the masters back. You don't know about any of that stuff. You just know that you want a deal.
Right.
And part of the deal, that's part of the paperwork, is that you sign your masters over. And, like, the devil's advocate in me is basically like, well, sucks for you.
Yeah.
Like, that's unfortunate, because if I, you know, Jody, I like your jacket. I'm going to buy this jacket from you. And then I take it and I go and I get it dirty, and or I get burned at a club or something.
Right.
And you'd be like, damn, I love that jacket. Mm-hmm. And I'll be like, well, too bad. It's my jacket now. And if I want to burn it, or if I happen to burn it, it's unfortunate, but it is what it is. It's not your problem. But there is this idea of kind of moral ownership, moral authority, and the art, even though the physical master belongs to the record label, even though the right to profit off that master largely belongs to the label, there is this kind of thing where it's like, I gave it up for adoption in a weird way.
Right.
It's still mine. To what degree is that a legally valid perspective? And we were talking a little bit about the copyright law and people pushing back against copyright ownership pre-1976. How does that kind of throw a wrench into who really owns the things that may have been lost?
So this is a question that I cannot speak to with any authority because I'm not a lawyer.
Doggist Popcast, there's no authority on this episode.
All right, word, let's go. No, but no, I mean, like, one thing that I, and this did not make it into the piece for precisely because I can't speak to it with any authority, and I
caveats
are on the table, and I couldn't get an entertainment industry lawyer really to speak to this. So, but what I will say, okay, fine. You've kind of laid out the moral terms of the thing here. In terms of the law, my question is, so there is this thing where the Copyright Act law of 1976 stipulated that artists could apply to have the copyrights revert to them after a period of 35 years, as long as those recordings were made post-1978. So I know of three artists, and there may be many, many more. These are just three that I kind of anecdotally happen to know of, who had stuff in the vault, who had made these copyright reversion requests. And those three artists are Joni Mitchell, Sting, and Peter Frampton, folks.
Hey, Frampton Comes Alive.
Yeah. Although Frampton Comes Alive was recorded, I think, before 78.
Oh, is
so
that true?
Sucks for him.
Sorry. But I really, all I know about Peter Frampton is that in Bloom County, I think someone got a, I can't forget the woman's name, the character in Bloom County, but she got a Peter Frampton tattoo, and I think Opus was really upset about it.
Yeah,
didn't know
that
who
sounds
Peter
right.
Frampton was. So anyway,
that
that's
right.
The extent of my Frampton jokes.
Wow. You took it back to Opus.
What I got.
But yeah. I don't really know a whole hell of a lot about Frampton either. But in any case, so those three artists made those requests. What I wondered about in this is, might other artists be able to make and sort of test the limits of the law, be able to make the argument, well, we might rightly have expected to make a copyright reversion request, and it was on UMG to be
custodians,
caretakers of this stuff.
To say nothing of just the responsibility.
They
to
mess that up.
Just
right.
We skip past that.
Right. So that's my question. Like, what's going to bubble up legally here?
Yeah.
In the aftermath of this, I mean, maybe not a whole hell of a lot that we'll hear about. It may all take place behind closed doors.
Sure.
UMG is the most, not only the most powerful record label in the world, but the most, at this point in history, like the most powerful record company that has ever existed.
Sure.
Their market share, it's insane what they control. So maybe there's aren't going to be a whole lot of artists that are going to want to lock horns with them, but you never know. You know, musicians are mercurial, feisty.
I mean, much to my joy.
Right,
that's exactly. That's why we do this.
That's what it's all about. So you know, we shall see. But what I will say is what you were outlining, which is like, look, not only are the record companies, might you expect them, hope that they would care about, I have to keep stopping myself from like swearing here.
No, it's fine.
I'm talking to Caramonica and I'm not used to filtering like
get
that.
In your bag. Get in your bag, Jody.
But anyway, the other thing is like they, in theory, they make a whole lot of noise, the record labels. Yep. They talk the talk of, oh, we care about the cultural patrimony here. You know, this is the heritage of this country and of the world, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, Caramonica's he's playing a violin. He's
tiny.
Yeah, air violin. And so for them to be saying that on the one hand and then
doing this
and then kind of screwing this up, and okay, they screwed it up. You know, there, you know, I heard from people who really care about this stuff. Mm-hmm. Look, it's not like the fact that this happened. This is a horrible accident. Maybe they shouldn't have had these things in a vault on the back lot of Universal Studios next to a King Kong ride, like near a whole bunch of super flammable movie sets, all that. But it happens. but it's the cover up is maybe too strong a word. The hush up.
Oh yeah.
Which
continued. I mean,
which sticks in your craw a bit.
We should also, I mean, you know, in the interest of fairness, we should acknowledge UMG's response to your story, mm-hmm. which is that it was full of inaccuracies, and I don't think it said falsehoods.
No, it didn't say falsehoods. It did say inaccuracies, and I think there was a suggestion that it was kind of overheated or melodramatic.
Speaking of overheating.
Yeah, there you go. But like, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So but they didn't identify any details. Well, there was no...
What they did say, right. So there was a dearth of specifics in this pushback. Mm-hmm. What they did say, which, I mean, honestly, like... You know, there's good people at UMG, and I do think that they are right when they're saying they're doing a better job of this now and take this stuff seriously. And I'm sure they'll take it extra seriously now. But, and there are certainly individuals, many who are working the archiving operation there who care deeply about this stuff and understand these issues on a profound level. All that stipulated, the only thing that they said in the statement by way of like, here's your proof, is we've released a whole lot of reissues since this fire. And it was master quality, which is not a phrase I've ever heard before.
Who is the big philosopher of language? Is it Wittgenstein? There's some philosopher of language who can perhaps unpack.
You went to Harvard, John.
Barely some days, let's be honest.
You tell me who it was.
But there's definitely some creativity with word choice.
Right, yeah. So they were kind of talking around the problem. And just for me to push back on that a little bit. Okay, yeah. The fact that they have put out some reissues. Doesn't mean that they're putting out the reissues from the math. It doesn't mean a single thing.
And like dog.
So that's
anyone whoever wrote that statement. We see you, man.
Yeah,
we see you. Just FYI.
Yeah. So
if you're a podcast listener, especially, we see you. Look, there was this record label pushback to the piece, but artists know, as you mentioned, some of them had been posting on message boards and yada yada. The first artist that came out publicly to say, "Yeah, we knew about this, or at least this is a problem," was Questlove. From the Roots, alluding to the fact that the masters for the first two Roots albums, not counting Organics, all you backpack nerds, the first two Roots albums that were major label albums were somehow not available and perhaps were lost in this fire. Let's listen to Distortion of Static.
This podcast is supported by Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy? Longtime equity advocate Angela Glover Blackwell looks at movement, struggle, and progress in Los Angeles to see what it can teach the nation about building a democracy that represents everyone. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm David Marchese.
And I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro.
And we're the hosts of The Interview from The New York Times.
David and I have spent our careers interviewing some of the most interesting and influential people in the world.
Which means we know when to ask tough questions and when to just sit back and listen.
And now we've teamed up to have these conversations every week. We'll try to reveal something about the people shaping our world.
And we'll get some great stories from them, too.
It's The Interview from The New York Times. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
They're trying to kind of nickel and dime the story on the idea of what a master is. The suggestion is that not everything in this vault was an original master, which is a point that I make in the piece right up top.
Yeah.
But there were a great number of these original masters mm-hmm. in there and a whole lot of stuff.
Can there be two masters of a thing?
There can only be one master, one true master.
Right.
There are lots of duplicate masters. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what Universal Music Group did in the aftermath of this fire was they launched something called the Phoenix Project, whereby they went all around the world to various recording studios, warehouses, places that were both in and out of their systems to try and recover these assets in whatever versions they could, which mm-hmm. by definition had less fidelity, didn't sure. sound as good. So for instance, this is a fact that didn't make it into the mm-hmm. piece, breaking news, like they found a large portion of the Impulse catalog.
Okay, that's great.
Copies, yeah.
That's not nothing.
In a closet at a Japanese record label, okay? Now, apparently, these were EQ masters, and this is like an esoteric fact that I didn't realize, but apparently Japanese listeners like a lot of high-end.
Mm.
So that was the quality of sound that they were getting on a lot of that stuff. So to say that they like recovered the Impulse masters, okay, they can now put a lot of reissues out there. How's that stuff going to sound? I don't know. Are you going to be looking at the original tape box that held John Coltrane's impressions? Are you going to be able to get extra takes that Coltrane did?
And again, it's sort of, do you conceive of yourself, if you work at a record label, do you conceive of yourself as an archivist of physical and increasingly digital objects?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you conceive of yourself as sort of like a spiritual protector of the music and we've got something that's close enough?
Right.
I would hope it would be... Well, I would hope be both.
Right.
But I certainly hope be the former.
Right.
But I think for many people, the latter suffices.
Right. And I think, to be fair, I think there's always historically been a disconnect between senior executives, between the and the people who count the money.
Yeah.
And the people who are actually the who physically are charged with the guardians, you know, the people in the vault, right?
Tell me about these people, because I was really interested to read about Aronson, who's mm-hmm. the guy at UMG,
mm-hmm.
who was in charge of that West Coast facility. But my experience with audiophiles and archivists, a very specific breed of person. Mm. I'm curious. You must have interacted with a bunch of them in the course of reporting. Tell me about these people and what are they like and what are their motivations?
Well, they care deeply about music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they care deeply about sound and getting the best possible sound out of a tape. And they are really, you know, they are what any other kind of archivist is. They care about history
yep.
and view themselves as like frontline soldiers in a battle to preserve and protect
mm-hmm.
these things. I mean, a lot of the people who work in that field have vast amounts of technical knowledge, historical knowledge, discographical knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period in the late 1980s after when CDs had
jumping.
Come along, right? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the labels realized, oh, we can monetize these
decaying tapes.
Right. Like, whoa, these catalogs can make us a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
And that's when we saw a box set boom and we saw a lot of great stuff come out. And thank God for that period.
Yeah.
Because, for instance, if you look at the Chess catalog, we got these great box sets that came out of that with a lot of extra material, including, like, in the case of Chuck Berry,
mm-hmm.
some stuff that was unearthed in the UMG vault by accident,
yeah.
by happenstance, you know what I mean, which wound up on those box
okay.
sets, like lost tracks,
mm-hmm.
which, if the CD boom hadn't happened, maybe all this stuff would have burned up.
Right, and right. No, or no one would have ever looked for them in the first place.
No one would ever look for them, right. So, but in any case, so that's what these people are. There was, anyway, in this period in the 80s, there were these kind of super duper, what they called vault detectives.
Mm-hmm.
People who knew their stuff and were charged with going in and like kind of doing archaeological
digs.
That's
a job I wouldn't mind having.
Yeah, right. And excavating this stuff. And like one of the interesting issues, complexities, whatever, paradoxes of where we stand now is now so many of the labels, including UMG, have all their stuff in third-party facilities.
Right. You mentioned Iron Mountain.
Iron
Mountain is sort of a storage information protection racket,
right.
I guess, and they have loads of secure locations.
Multi-billion dollar company, yeah, and they keep, like, so UMG keeps most of his stuff in this huge former limestone mine outside of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible facility. It's huge. They've got
armed guards
there. It's supposedly nuke-proof, like, you know, impervious to, like, a several megaton bomb blast,
great.
All that. And
Well, at least our cultural heritage will survive the impending nuclear apocalypse.
That's right. That's right.
So that's not nothing.
No, I mean, someday a species of highly evolved cockroach will come along, and they'll be able to get into whatever UMG has there. There won't be any metadata.
No, but that's all right.
It's all barcoded.
It's going to be such a highly advanced species that they're just going to press one virtual alien finger on it, and they'll know all the metadata.
There
just
you go.
Off the rip.
Now we're in the situation where that stuff is there, but once it goes into those facilities, it gets barcoded, right? And there's not a lot of access. You have great protection. The asset is safe.
Right.
But you're trading off access for safety and security.
Yeah, and detail that you mentioned in your piece, which I was very struck by, was every time a label wants to pull something, there's a fee attached to that. And it reminds me of these ads on the subway for like these virtual storage lockers. Mm-hmm. Where it's super cheap because they take everything and it's like, you know, you don't have to go to like Extra Space Storage or wherever.
Right.
You don't have to physically bring it there. But the secret thing is every time you want something, you got to pay for them to bring it back to you or for you to be able to access it. So that's just what this is on a billion-dollar scale.
Right, exactly. Scale. You have to pay a fee to get it out, and you have to pay a much higher fee even, as I understand it, to get a digital copy made, because a lot of these copies, like the labels all tout their digitization programs. Iron Mountain has these studios and facilities there where
I thought that was fascinating.
It's cool. Yeah. They can do it on site, but the labels aren't ponying up the kind of money to get everything digitized. What they're digitizing is Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're digitizing Marley. They're digitizing the stuff that people want to hear. That's the stuff they're backing up. But are they going to back up, you know, long tail weird obscurities? But to go back to like what I was talking about, this period in the CD era, what you had then, you had these vault detectives, and what they did is they got down and dirty.
Yeah.
And they were able to, you know, route through the stuff in these vaults. They had a whole lot of institutional knowledge that they brought. Oh, wait, I pulled that tape over there. I saw some weird thing. It was unlabeled over there. I'm going to go back up there and check it out. And sure, you know, often as not, they would find some hidden gem there. I spoke to one guy who said that he was messing around. He's the guy who worked on a lot of chess material, including the Chuck Berry material. Mm-hmm. And he was messing around somewhere and he saw a tape box that just said four on it, F-O-U-R. He's like, huh, what's that, I wonder? And left it. And then eventually he was like, he got curious about it. Wait, I'm going to go back up that shelf and see what that thing is. He pulled it and it was the first recordings made for chess by the Four Tops in the 50s.
Oh, come on.
You know, this is pre-Motown Four Tops, right? And so that's the kind of stuff. There's so many things like that. You know, Randy Aronson, who is the director of vault operations, the guy who essentially ran UMG's vault for years and the kind of the main character in my piece, he said, okay, yeah, there were chess session masters in there. They just said session. Don't know what was on it. Nobody pulled the tape and put the tape up.
Right.
So there's just so many unknowns.
Yeah.
That went the way of all things.
One of the things that you point out is that Aretha's early recordings with her father apparently were lost as well. Her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin. Let's listen to what I believe is the first song that they released, and that is Never Grow Old. What is the intellectual chasm between the people who we're talking about, these kind of detective and preservationist figures, and the record label executives? Talk to me about that chasm. And based on your reporting, are the people who specialize in these kinds of things being given the resources that would be required to adequately protect these assets? Which they are assets. You say that. And again, it's unromantic,
right?
It's not romantic. It's not cool.
No.
It's not like sexy to be like, oh, it's a corporate asset.
Yeah.
We think it's art. I'm talking about art all day
long. Well, there you go. I think there's the rub right there, right? So maybe the people in the vault don't view them as, even if they have to use that language, they don't think of them first and foremost as assets. And maybe that's the way poorly chosen phrase, but the bean counters, you know, the people who really have to worry about the money, and the people who sit in the executive boardrooms, et cetera, the way they feel about it. Cause they are assets, and they're trying to exploit this stuff commercially and make some money off it. And the fact is that for years and years, these vaults were viewed rightly for some time as cost centers, not profit centers. This is before, you know, the advent of this catalog boom and reissues really became a thing, right?
Was it Atlantic that lost a bunch and then they got an insurance payout and they were like, this is great.
Right. And this is
a couple million dollars.
Yeah. Atlantic is a real helpful way of thinking about it historically because, okay, like to go back to your original question about this kind of gulf between the people in the vault and the people who run the labels, that didn't exactly always exist, which is not to say that record labels haven't been screwing this stuff up for decades, because what we have is a century plus long history of like trashing the masters, sawing up the reels, donating everything to scrap metal drives, putting them in dumpsters, putting them in landfills, things getting lost in floods and fires, all that. And that has happened. It's not just UMG. This takes place in a context of like a century long history of the record labels being poor caretakers of this material. That said, in the past, if you think about Atlantic, the people who founded that label, they deeply cared about music.
Right.
When labels were smaller,
absolutely,
before corporate consolidation,
yeah,
you had music people, for the most part, who were running labels. That didn't mean that they weren't exploitative mother effers, right? But like,
they were charming exploitative,
right,
and they were artistically inclined.
Right. Think about the Chess Brothers,
mm-hmm,
okay? I mean, they're very problematic legacy in terms of
stripping artists of their profits and their rights.
Yeah.
But great ear.
Right. Exactly. And so to go back to Atlantic, right? So they, in their Midtown office, they had all these, not their album masters now,
mm-hmm,
all their outtakes, session masters,
mm-hmm,
from the late 1940s up through the early 70s. Think about who was on Atlantic in that time. I mean, everybody, right? Just do the very top line, like Aretha, Ray Charles, Coltrane, Ornette, Joe Turner, whatever. Everybody, Ruth Brown.
Yeah.
Okay. So all the stuff that never made it on an album was sitting in Midtown Manhattan office, and they were like, this is taking up too much room. Let's get it out of here. Sheldon Vogel, very nice, well-meaning, mm-hmm, man, who is the CFO of the company, mm-hmm, said, oh, my family, we used to have this department store in Long Branch, New Jersey. It's now empty. It's been empty for 3 years. Let's go all stick it in there. And they built all these shelves, and they built wooden shelves so it wouldn't magnetize and screw up the recordings. But wooden shelves don't hold up in a fire. And apparently, they wondered about arson for a while, but what the firemen and the police theorized was that a bum broke into the building to sleep, a bum, quote unquote, and had a cigarette and fell asleep. And up went, you know, 5,000 to 6,000 of these things. And to think about what the lost music was there, it boggles the mind. Anyway, the point being, even in that era where the kind of overlords really cared about music.
Right.
And they're the reason that we have so much music. They, mm-hmm, got these masters wrong because it wasn't understood that these were assets, that they were monetizable, mm-hmm, right? They were viewed as stuff that was taking up room and as kind of dross, right? And so now where we're at is because of consolidation, we've got so many record labels that have come under the umbrella of three gigantic ones, which in turn are operated by global media conglomerates. In the case of UMG, which is operated by a French, Vivendi.
And as you point out in the piece, someone in the head office, the CFO, is looking at the spreadsheet and it says storage,
right,
37 million.
Right.
And it's like, hey, maybe that could be 27 million.
Right.
So someone fix that.
And, you know, and UMG is making bank now. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what the people who really care about these issues say, if you wanted to have the ideal situation, UMG would build a few really good proprietary vaults
not Iron Mountain,
that offer all the same things that Iron Mountain has.
Right.
They'd just sink a whole hell of a lot of money into it.
Mm-hmm.
They would sink a whole hell of a lot of money into backing up all this stuff.
Yeah.
And rebacking it up, given the way that obsolescence works in the digital era.
Yeah.
Right. And in inventorying it properly, like putting every single tape up and figuring out what was on this stuff.
Right. But I mean, to be fair,
right,
I mean, I can't even get metadata on Spotify. So it's like, if they can't even get the metadata for like literally a song that's on the top 10 right now.
Right.
what are the odds that they're going to employ basically probably a bunch of out of work music journalists to go back?
I think we've just solved the problem.
That's true. It's a real supply and demand thing because Lord knows it's a supply. Yeah. Were there during this time period, last 20 to 30 years, were there best practices of audio preservation that were being used elsewhere that were not being used by record labels?
I'd say yes. One institution you can look to is the Library of Congress.
Just what I was thinking.
Okay, so a few years ago, they moved their recorded sound and film operation to Culpeper, Virginia.
Okay.
To a site that had formerly been an underground site where the Treasury kept a whole lot of cash in the event, again, of a nuclear attack.
Wow.
Like enough cash to jumpstart the economy east of the Mississippi.
Oh.
And that stuff, and that
there's a movie in there. Yeah, yeah. we're gonna rob the treasure.
Yeah. Oh my God! Yeah,
yeah, it's good.
Okay,
I get points if anybody.
Yeah,
writes
that's right.
That,
whoever writes that,
we get points.
So that came up for sale. The federal government grabbed it. The Library of Congress moved all their recordings there. It's an incredible facility.
Have you been?
I have been, and the reason I've been is because in the aftermath of this fire in 2011, I believe, 2010, 2011, Universal Music Group made a huge donation of the oldest or most of the oldest of its still extant masters, stuff that wasn't stored in the backlot vault.
Okay.
These are mostly old lacquer and metal parts masters dating from the mid-20s up through the late 40s. And that was a, quote, mile of music. A couple hundred thousand, maybe 250,000 of these things, which are now, it was donated to the Library of Congress.
But also because they probably didn't want to take care of it themselves.
Exactly. I mean, not to be cynical, but. No, it's a good deal for them and arguably for the American people because, so here's the deal, right? The Library of Congress preserves it. They like own the physical stuff forever. UMG retains the intellectual property. UMG can exploit it commercially if, for instance, there's a Ukulele Ike revival and suddenly everybody wants to hear Ukulele Ike or, you know, the Mills Brothers from some period that is covered by these metal parts masters, right? They can say to the Library of Congress, hey, digitize this stuff for me. They'll do a really good digital transfer.
Of course.
And UMG gets to make money off it. But what we, the taxpayers, get, because we are now funding this archive, is we get good preservation of a cultural heritage.
Sure.
It should be mentioned, by the way, that I wasn't able to nail this down, but sources tell me, sources who know, that UMG received a big tax break for this, which is fine. It's a donation.
No problem.
Right? They also, and this is really to the point, they save a whole hell of a lot because it costs a lot to keep your stuff in Iron Mountain.
Yeah, sure.
So now the federal government and the taxpayers are paying for this preservation. But it's great because we have, because there's, in theory, access. If a scholar wants to go hear the complete run of Andrew's Sisters masters, Decca masters that are from this era,
it's there.
They can go to the Library of Congress
and they have
in Washington, D.C. They will pull it in Culpeper, make digital transfers, and they'll send it digitally there. And the scholar can sit there with these headphones like the ones I'm wearing and listen to it. So one question you might ask is, well, is this a model going forward?
Yeah, sure.
Should the Library of Congress be charged with, as opposed to a for-profit corporation?
For many years, the Library of Congress received copies of all recordings, I believe, that I assume the major labels. Like, I don't know if, like, Discord was sending.
Right.
Although that'd be great if Discord was sending stuff to the Library of Congress. Probably not. But you know what I mean? Like, at least the major labels were sending copies. Is that still a thing? Is that not a thing?
It's a problem because that was part of the Copyright Act of 1976. I think it dates to that period. But in any case, yeah. So after a certain period, beginning in the mid-70s, all the labels, every commercially released recording in the United States, a copy was furnished to the Library of Congress so that they had a complete record of commercially released music in the United States for that period, up until a few years ago, because at that time, there were fewer and fewer CDs being released by record companies. A lot more stuff was simply being born digital, being born as MP3 or as, you know, now streaming files, right? And the law has not caught up with it. So there is no you know, e-digital deposit program there.
There's no chance the rapper's second album?
Nope.
Oh my gosh.
And there's no
Pat the manager, fix that.
Right.
Email the Library of Congress.
Email the Library, and there's
get
no
them a zip file.
All of our very important SoundCloud rappers.
Oh. The deep low pump cuts, D Rose outtakes. I need all that.
All that. Not in there, but like we joke, but
no,
this is a real problem because like now, like there's a huge gaping hole. Like a librarian at the Library of Congress told me we're missing a whole lot of stuff. There's a big gap now from about 2010 going forward. So
we're missing about a decade's
worth of digital music.
I mean, this is something I've sort of communicated with some preservationists on Twitter over the years because I think a lot about everything that was lost, like with Vine or, you know, when Zshare or Mega Upload, like all those file hosting services that were home to endless zip files, a lot of copyright infringement as well.
Yep.
Shrug. Yep. What are you going to do? Uh-huh. But, you know, home to a lot of important stuff is just gone.
Right.
And even at a certain point, the websites will fall off the internet and they won't be indexed or archived. Right. So we won't even have the index of what was lost,
right,
to say nothing of the thing that was lost.
Right.
And that drives me nuts. And as someone who probably up until 2 years ago really downloaded every single thing, like I always downloaded, now I feel like I'm just like, ah, it's fine, it'll be there, when I know in my heart it may not be there, but that's extremely sad,
and it likely won't be. I mean, you could even make an argument that it's more likely that it won't be there. And you know, this is one of the things I actually tweeted a little bit about this myself today.
That's right.
But if you think about YouTube, okay?
Oh, don't okay. Even.
So YouTube, like most of the
most
of the streaming music that people take in the world is on YouTube.
So true.
Okay? And on the one hand, it's a godsend for people who are into weird old music or any old music because a lot of out of print lives on YouTube because
quasi legitimate stuff,
right? All forms,
boots,
right?
Yep.
Right, because people are doing things like they're doing needle transfers from the vinyl, and they're putting up a whole cool album.
Yep.
That isn't on Spotify.
Yep.
That's great, but in fact, you can make an argument that this is okay. This is kind of a user generated huge.
This is
conservation project.
This is the Celestial Jukebox.
That's the Celestial Jukebox. Not only is this Celestial Jukebox, this is 21st century archiving and preservation.
Absolutely.
You know,
that's how I view
guerrilla
it.
Guerrilla style.
That's how I view
but,
it. But if anybody ever needs my expert testimony in a court of law.
There you go. But here's the rub, right? What's YouTube? It's Google.
Yeah.
So it's owned by a for-profit corporation.
Absolutely.
And it's owned by a corporation. Whatever. The point is, it ain't the Library of Congress. And it could, for any given reason, any and all of that music could just
evaporate. They have done that with other things. I think there was like an archive of old Letterman. Now, obviously, copyright infringements, yada, yada, yada. But like, hell, like, so they're a big company. Like, they could figure out a way to make it legit.
Right.
But they just, I forget the name of the guy, but he had posted, you know, years and years and years of episodes, and like one day woke up and they were just gone.
It was gone. Well, actually, interestingly enough, you know, those are probably Letterman's like NBC era stuff, right?
Yeah.
A whole lot of TV shows and film was lost in the same vault fire, like a hell of a lot more stuff than was in the music vault. And somebody needs to report that out because there's a lot of television stuff that we are not seeing on streaming services or Netflix, and that may be the reason why.
I asked you to email me a few things. At the end of your piece, you talk about one particular album, but I also asked you to email me a few things. So first let's talk about what you close your piece with. Tell me about the Prince Teddy album.
Okay, well, here's the context, right? It's like in that part of the piece, I write about the fact that, at a certain point, I sort of had taken stock of these huge losses to these great artists who we all know. I'd kind of taken stock of all these major artists, these household names, all this music that was lost. And we've talked about the extent and the different ways in which that music was lost, right? But the fact remains that something close to all of the most important music by these artists that we know about, as opposed to like the unreleased stuff that burnt up in the fire.
Right.
I can grab my iPhone and, you know, listen to some Chuck Berry, listen to some Billie Holiday, right? But I started to wonder about these other more obscure artists, because a lot of what was in this vault was material on weird little sub-labels, some of which you may have heard of, some of which you may not have heard
Early consolidation.
Right.
Like, not current consolidation, but basically when small labels sold their catalogs in the 60s or 70s to something that eventually became part of Universal.
Right. So Chess had a bunch of great sub-labels, and Decca Records had a lot of little sub-labels. The music on this stuff, I started to look for, because I was like, what was in this vault that is going to be harder and harder to find now?
Right.
Because, of course, the history of music is a history of, like, overlooking a lot of great stuff. And then, if indeed it is still around, rediscovering it years or decades later, right? There's just like there's a technological time lag where the playback technology and the recording technology don't line up. There's the lag in terms of, like, something getting put out in the world, it flopping commercially, and then, what do you know, tastes evolve, times change, and then you never know. Suddenly something that everybody slept on in 1972 sounds like the best thing you've ever heard.
It ends up, you know, some music supervisor puts in a film, and then all of a sudden it just,
like, whoa.
Yes.
So I started to go looking for that stuff, and one label in particular that I focused on was this label called AVI. AVI?
I think AVI.
Yeah, but I think it's AVI myself. Yeah. Someone said AVI to me recently, and I was like, sounds like my Israeli cousin. but in any case, so AVI. And AVI put out a lot of weird, interesting music. And one of those records, which has a very, very small digital footprint, i.e. there's 2.5 songs that were uploaded to YouTube, was this thing called the Prince Teddy album by this guy named Don Bennett, who turned out to be a super fascinating figure who had his fingers in garage rock. Mm-hmm. He's a black guy, grew up in Pasadena, had his fingers in the garage rock scene in the late 60s in L.A., also played in a lot of soul bands, played in a kind of Jimi Hendrix-inspired hard rock trio, was a pretty amazing arranger and songwriter based on, like, the little scraps of his discography that are out there floating around the internet.
Yeah.
And he put out one album under his own name, this thing, the Prince Teddy album, which dates from 1977. And I put on this, I bought this record for $75 on Discogs.
And it's now not available on Discogs anymore. Do you think it sold out because of this article?
100%. I checked it before the article dropped. And I was like, I bet these 7 albums that are available are going to go.
All gone.
Sure enough, they didn't. And it was really a revelatory record because it's a little Sly Stone-ish.
Yep.
But also kind of like I hate this term, but a little outsider music-ish. Like
you're totally right.
You know what I mean? Like his voice, he's like, his pitch is maybe a little funky.
Yeah, it's like, it's non-linear.
Right.
Yeah.
But like it's a really great record. So
let's listen to Don't Want to Spoil Your High, which is off this album.
Listen to nobody, yeah, yeah. Hey, I speak my words of wisdom, gonna make it very clear. Bend your head right over, baby, I whisper in your ear, yeah.
You also sent through a few more kind of like Lucy's, and I listened to them. I had no expectations. You gave me a link and a name and an artist name, but I didn't know anything about what was going to come. And it was nice to approach something completely context-free.
Right.
That was actually really cool. One that really jumped out at me was this track by The Consolers.
Yes, that's my favorite one that I sent to you, besides Prince Teddy.
It's called Gimme My Flowers. This is a gospel song. Mm-hmm. This is a married couple gospel song, 1955. Let's listen to a little Gimme My Flowers.
Give me my flowers. Oh, yes. While I yet live. Hey,
what you think about it, but I want you to speak kind words to me. Every once in a while, I can hear them.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'm not super fluent in the gospel of this era, but I'm not sure if the consolers are part of a centrist narrative of the gospel of that era. Is that, do you know?
I honestly don't know.
Yeah, either. I don't
right.
know.
Yeah.
This was my first encounter.
Right.
And when I was listening to it, I was like, if there's 50 more songs like this, like, I want to hear these. Like, this is,
right.
this has got to be part of the history.
Right.
If it's not. And I had that reaction to several of these records. You should be tweeting these records, to be honest. This Gail McCorick song I thought was stellar.
Yeah.
So good.
Dusty Springfield-ish.
Yeah. Yeah. But like a little, like almost like a little bit winkier.
Yeah.
Like a little bit like,
yep.
little va-va in it. The Unforgiven.
Yeah.
Unforgiven.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I was really moved by a lot of these records and then subsequently very upset at all the things I don't know.
Right. And that's what this process has been for me, like going to kind of crate digging after these obscurities has really like driven this home for me, which is like, I thought I knew a thing or two about music and we don't know.
Yeah.
Like there's, and that's actually in a way, it's a beautiful thing to realize because there's just so much good music that has been made. And the thing is like, it's a pity that a lot of it burnt up and let's put it that way. And this material is like, because the masters are gone, like, a lot of this material will only survive in these little scraps, and to the extent that someone like has something and has put it up on YouTube, and
this is, you know, it's funny, we're talking about Discogs. Discogs obviously a really valuable resource. Every now and again, I find something like in my digging that's not on Discogs,
right?
And I feel like almost like a moral obligation to just input it,
right?
Just to put it there,
right?
It's like, it's nice if someone buys the record, but it's really more like, people should just know that this thing exists. Like, I've stumbled upon things at record shops when I Google, literally has a Google footprint of zero.
Right.
No hits. And I'm just like, well, I have it. So maybe five other people would be curious about it. And I just feel there is an imperative to know. And so I update it. And that's what I think people like you and I are like.
Exactly. And you know, I mean, I know that an argument can and will, and in fact has been made that, okay, so we don't have every single record that was ever recorded under the auspices of a record company or not, right? So what? That it will always be, it'll ever be thus. Like, there's no way you can have a complete record, but of this stuff. But on the other hand, if there's like beauty out in the world that somebody like, you know, I mean, not to be corny about it, but like poured their heart and soul, if somebody made some great art.
Yeah.
Isn't it something that we should like invest some resources in keeping around?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, so much of what I do and you do and people like us do, it's about our personal enjoyment and appreciation, but it's also about bringing something out of the dark and like bringing it a little bit into the light just so that others might behold or listen or whatnot. And that is something to know the impossibility of that with this category, this stockpile that's now poof.
Right.
Will probably enrage me for a long time to come.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that may be a good note to end on, but let me just say one other thing, which is just that, like, we live in the United States still, I think.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, this is like, let's get real, like, like recorded music, that's our thing. That's our thing. That's our great heritage. Like, that's our gift to world culture.
Yeah.
Right. And also these are like the kind of documents that's most eloquently like speak our story, right? Yeah. Like our history is told even through music, right? That's like a record of the time, which is more eloquent than as any other source.
Yeah.
Right. So
what are we doing?
What are we doing? What are we doing? It should not burn up next to a King Kong ride.
Jody, we're not going to let you go on a totally sad note, even though all is lost and black clouds of tragedy hover above us everywhere we walk. Let's play Louie Louie by the Kingsmen, which has also been lost to time, the master of which apparently has been lost to time. But at least for the next 30 seconds, will bring us a tiny fragment of joy.
Yeah.
Before we go this week, I wanted to point your attention towards another article that came out not that long ago, kind of talking about a different side of archiving and the challenges associated with that. In the LA Times, Randall Roberts wrote about Gary Stewart. Gary Stewart was an A&R guy at Rhino Records, kind of during the peak reissue boom. He was also hired by Steve Jobs to impose some kind of order onto the iTunes universe in the early iTunes moment. He was a person who helped reorient how people viewed catalog. Catalog is a big mess. It's millions and millions and millions of songs by millions of artists. And he was one of the people in the 80s through the 2000s helping to impose some discipline and some reorganized frameworks onto what catalog could be. So Gary Stewart committed suicide last month, and Randall wrote a really nice and thoughtful piece about his influence and about the kind of tragedy of his passing. And now I'm not naive enough to think that it's a simple question of algorithms come along and do the job of historical knowledge that people long did. But I do know that there are people, much like the preservationists that we were talking about earlier in the episode, there is a different kind of preservation that's not the physical preservation of a reel or of a digital file, but there is a historical preservation, a storehouse of knowledge. And hearing about the passing of Gary Stewart and also his frustrations prior to his death about how the music business was changing and was decreasingly reliant upon people with his particular knowledge strengths, I found very hard and challenging, and it hit really close to home. Also, I want to thank my friend Naomi for sharing this article with me. We've spent the last hour talking about what happens when files are lost, what history you can't recover. But history isn't just about raw data. It's not just about files. It's not just about artifacts. History is about knowledge and framework and contextualization. And that is as important towards remaking history as the artifacts and the files. And so I want to remember Gary Stewart's life. And I feel like we should all be preservationists of a sort. We should all be curators of a sort of histories that are fragile. So I guess let's go out today with, you know, something that's not super rare. I was thinking of what's the rarest thing I can play and recontextualize, but that's not that. I don't want to play that game, but let's go out with something that is important to me personally and lives in a kind of commercial limbo and might disappear forever, except for the MP3 that I've got of it somewhere. So let's play the Big L verse from the Big L and Jay-Z freestyle on Stretch and Bobbito, and let's all be better stewards of our history.
All right, Big L, pardon the technical difficulties.
Check it out.
Yeah.
Check Ha-ha. It out. Alright. Check
if
it out.
You want to put your man on too, you can do it together.
Alright. Yeah. I'm going to set it off like this. Check it out. Yo, check it. Yo, I got slugs for snitches. No love for just putting thugs in ditches with my trigger finger itches. I got a rep to make police jet. Known to get a pre-sweat. I never.
That's our show. Thank you to Jody Rosen. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Hopefully they will exist forever. Maybe I'll have Pedro make me a zip file so that I'll have them. God forbid. God forbid the streaming overlords take it away someday. Just a quick sidebar. So in the 90s, which was a long time ago, I took in college the first class that was ever offered on rap music. It was a graduate music seminar. There's only a couple of undergraduates in there, kind of a motley crew of master students and PhD students and a couple of undergrads like myself. And one of the tasks that that class undertook was, I think, to decide, I can't remember if it was 10 or 20, but to choose 10 or 20 rap albums that would be acquired by and owned by the Harvard Library System as a first step towards building an archive. At that time, I don't think I even fully understood the import of that. I was just so busy being like, we got to have Illmatic. We got to have Illmatic. But when I think about it now, it was a valuable step. And I actually wonder if those records are still in the system. If anybody goes to school there and can check whatever the online database is, I'd be curious to know if those albums are still there. It's either 10 or 20, and they would have been acquired around 1996, I think. Email me any of your thoughts on archiving and preservation, or hell, if you got some documents about some raw files that have gone missing or been burned in a fire, I'd love to see those too at popcastnytimes.com. And subscribe to Popcast anywhere that your audio content exists. Our producer, who is equally upset this week, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, and we'll be back next week.
Yeah. Jay-Z. I was just wondering if that was a condom endorsement.
Oh, nah.
Yeah, we got Jay. We also got the graveyard, right? That's coming up next with Jay-Z on it. But we got Jay-Z in the place. What's up, baby?
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.